Thank you, Father, for this good day, this lovely day, and we ask that you would pour out your grace upon us now, and as we interact with one another, help us to do everything that you enable us to do to stir up one another toward love and good deeds. Bless now our time together and help us to figure it out a little bit more, again, under your direct tutelage by the Spirit of Truth. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Today, we're going to talk about pretending and performing. Pretending and performing. And how these are hindrances to the progress of the gospel in our lives. And last week, we started to talk about how we shrink the cross. And this week, we're going to find out that one of the chief ways, or two of the chief ways, are pretending and performing. Would anyone be willing to read the brief review of last week's discussion out loud? Anyone? Go ahead, Faith. Top of your handout, by the way. Sorry.
Yes. Brief review of last week's discussion. The gospel grid, thinking accurately about God and ourselves. Cross chart and the two lines, God concept and self concept. Where we minimize our sin, we are also minimizing the gospel. We often minimize our sin by clever mechanisms, for example, defending, faking, hiding, exaggerating, blaming, downplaying, etc. These are discussed on page 7. Another way of minimizing sin is by comparing our righteous self to the unrighteous selves around us and judging those, quote unquote, poor, unfortunate souls, discussed on page 7.
Great. Does anyone know that line, poor, unfortunate souls? Yes. I should say, poor, unfortunate souls. It's the sea witch in The Littlest Mermaid. Little Mermaid. And yes, we always look around us and find those poor, unfortunate souls who are just so sinful, and we're so glad that we're not like them. We're going to read two stories from Luke chapter 18. Really, one is a parable and one is a story. And we're going to read the parable first. It's pretty straightforward. So let's read it and answer a couple questions about it. Would anyone be willing to read the first paragraph under Luke 18? Mike, would you mind?
Sure.
And then the second paragraph. Would anyone read the second paragraph? Tony, thank you.
And he also told this parable to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself: God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get.
But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted.
All right. With which of these two characters do you most associate?
The first one.
First one? Okay.
I know that now.
Thank you. I know that because that's what I do. I'm with you. What do you like about the Pharisee, and what do you not like about the Pharisee? Is there anything you might like about a Pharisee? He seems confident. That's great. You know, they said that some years ago, I think it was like 15 years ago, they did this survey among American students, and they found, you know, they did... we're rolling, Dwight, thank you. They did all these testing to figure out where American kids score in contrast to Germans and Japanese and, you know, different English, whatever. And we scored very low in many of the categories, but there was one category we excelled and we were flying high, and it was the degree of self-confidence that kids have. And think about that. I'm so self-confident, even though, you know, we're going to be the lowest in the world. But we're confident. But yes, you're right. He was confident. Anything else that you might like about a Pharisee?
Realizes Alex. That law is important.
Yes, realizes that love is important. It's important to tithe. It's important to fast. Spiritual disciplines are important. Good. Anything else?
He is obeying.
You know, there's a type of obedience.
He does give thanks to the Lord for his righteousness. That is, you know, only because of him that he's that way. Like, I thank you that I am not like other people.
Yes. Notice to whom, though, that his prayer is directed. The Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself. I mean, it's a way of saying it was saying it silently or whatever.
Right.
But you do feel that maybe Luke, you know, kind of got that in there. He was, yes.
I like his discipline.
His discipline. Which of the two would you like to have as a next door neighbor?
Pharisee.
I mean, man, if you're going to ask for a cup of sugar, he's going to give you a cup where the grains of sugar are counted. Did you say cups there, Beth? It's going to be exactly a cup. You know, the tax collector, you're going to knock on his door, and he's going to get up. His hair is going to be all disheveled, and maybe he's a little intoxicated from the night before. And he says, I don't have any sugar. You know, would you take flour? And you're going to, no, flour is not going to help me in this situation. All right, so again, there's that about the Pharisee. What about the tax collector? What? How might you describe a tax collector?
Humble.
He's humble. Okay. Anything you would dislike about him?
He's taking my hard-earned money.
Okay, yeah, excellent. And in that case, you know, he's an agent of a foreign government.
But he's following the law.
He is following the law. How so?
He's following Roman law.
He's following Roman's law. That's right. And he's exacting that money from, you know, as he should. Maybe telling Tracy, you owe 20 bucks, so that'll be 25.
Yeah.
You know, and he gets a little surcharge.
He was allowed by Roman law to do.
And he was allowed, like Ticketmaster, right?
Yes.
Sorry. What would you say about their God image and their self image?
Tax collector knew that he needed God to be merciful.
Yes, he knew that he needed God's mercy.
We talked about imitating God versus transcending God. There's more of a transcendent concept.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, remember the view of the holiness of God versus the transcendence versus the immanence of God. He's more focused on the holiness and transcendence of God. But also there's something about getting mercy personally. You know, he has that hope. Be merciful to me.
He's got a relationship.
Looks like he has a relationship, yeah. Okay. The tax collector, do you think he has a high view of God or a low view of God? And in what sense? Think he has a high view?
He sees quite a distance between himself and God.
The tax collector. Okay. What about the Pharisee? Do you think he has a high view of God or a low view?
Low.
He probably thinks he's on par with God.
Oh, okay. Because, again, he prays to himself. Okay. He does the will of God. You know, as someone said, there's an obedience there. He could show you his checkbook and show you that 10%. I mean, even when his mint plant in the backyard grows 10 inches, he whacks off an inch and brings it to the temple in a little envelope. Right? So he has a high view of God in that he knows God must be obeyed. I would say he has a low view of God in as much as he feels like God can be obeyed in human sweat, strength. This saying behind me, I just wanted to say a word about it. Cheer up. We say it around here a lot. We got this saying from Jack Miller, who was a professor of theology at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. And Jack Miller, Gordon, some of you know Gordon Woolard. Gordon Woolard was part of their first church plant knew them very well. His wife, he died. His wife is in her 90s and is participating in a church plant in the Asian part of London. Jack Miller used to say, and I think it's kind of caught on in our denomination, not among everyone in our denomination, he used to say, cheer up. You're much worse off than you think you are. But in the gospel, you're more secure, cherished, and significant than you've ever imagined. And that's really good, I think, for the Christian's self-image, that you're more sinful than you've imagined, and you are more cherished than you've ever dreamed. And just really important to keep those two things simultaneously in mind all the time. And that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to move along these lines. All right, if we could turn now to the essay that we're going to read, Shrinking the Cross, Pretending and Performing. Mike, I know you've already read, but if we could start this way, and then we'll just, if you don't feel like reading, just tap the person next to you and they'll go on. Go ahead.
Last week we looked at a model that illustrates what it means to live in light of the gospel. This week we want to look more closely at the ways we minimize the gospel and reduce its impact in our lives.
Notice that the top line of the chart is labeled Growing Awareness of God's Holiness. As we stated last time, this does not mean that God's holiness itself is increasing. For God is unchangeable in his character. He has always been infinitely holy. Rather, this line shows that when the gospel is functioning correctly in our lives, our awareness of God's holy character is constantly growing. We realize in fuller and deeper ways the weight of God's glorious perfections.
Likewise, the bottom line shows that when the gospel is functioning correctly in our lives, our awareness of our own sinfulness is consistently growing. This does not mean that we are becoming more sinful. In fact, if we're growing in Christ, we'll be starting to see victory over sin. But we are realizing more and more how deep the rabbit hole goes in our character and behavior. We are seeing that we are more profoundly sinful than we first imagined.
As these two lines diverge, the cross becomes larger in our experience, producing a deeper love for Jesus and a fuller understanding of his goodness. At least that's the ideal. But in reality, because of indwelling sin, we are prone to forget the gospel, to drift away from it like a boat loosed from its moorings. That's why the Bible urges us not to be moved away from the hope held out in the gospel, and to let the word of Christ dwell in us richly. When we are not anchored in the truth of the gospel, our love for Jesus and our experience of his goodness become very small. We end up shrinking the cross by either pretending or performing.
But begin at the bottom line of the chart. Growing in our awareness of our sinfulness is not fun. It means admitting to ourselves and others that we're not as good as we think we are. It means confronting what Richard Lovelace called the complex web of compulsive attitudes, beliefs, and behavior that sin has created in us. If we're not resting in Jesus' righteousness, this growing awareness of our sin becomes a crushing weight. We buckle under its load and compensate by pretending that we're better than we really are. Pretending can take many forms. Dishonesty, not that bad. Comparison, not as bad as those people. Excuse making, I'm not really that way. And false righteousness, here are all the good things I've done. Because we don't want to admit how simple we really are, we spin the truth in our favor.
Growing in our awareness of God's holiness is also challenging. It means coming face to face with God's righteous commands and the glorious perfections of his character. It means realizing how dramatically we fall short of his standards. It means reflecting on his holy displeasure towards sin. If we are not rooted in God's acceptance of us through Jesus, we compensate by trying to earn God's approval through our performance. We live life on a treadmill, trying to gain God's favor by living up to his expectations or our mistaken view of them.
It is easy to talk about pretending and performing in the abstract, but let's consider how these tendencies find practical expression in our lives.
To discern your subtle tendencies toward pretending, ask yourself this question. What do you count on to give you a sense of personal credibility, validity, acceptance, good standing? Your answer to that question will also reveal something besides Jesus in which you find righteousness. When we are not firmly rooted in the gospel, we rely on these false sources of righteousness to build our reputation and give us a sense of worth and value. Here are some examples.
Job righteousness, hard worker, so God will reward me.
Family righteousness, because I do things right as a parent, I'm more godly than parents who can't control them.
Theological righteousness. I have good theology. God prefers me over those who have bad theology.
Intellectual righteousness. I am better read, more articulate. I'm more culturally savvy than others, which obviously makes me secure.
A schedule of righteousness. I am self-disciplined and rigorous in my time management, which makes me more mature than others.
Flexibility righteousness. In a world that's busy, I'm flexible and relaxed. I always make time for others. Shame on those who don't.
Good to laugh. Good to laugh at ourselves.
Mercy righteousness. I care about the poor and disadvantaged the way everyone else should.
Legalistic righteousness. I don't drink, smoke, or chew, or date girls who do. Too many Christians just aren't concerned about holiness these days.
Financial righteousness. I manage money wisely and stay out of debt. I am not like those materialistic Christians who cannot control their spending.
Political righteousness. If you really love God, you'll vote for my candidate.
Tolerance righteousness. I'm open-minded and charitable towards those who don't agree with me. In fact, I'm a lot like Jesus.
There are just a few examples. Perhaps you can think of many more. Think of anything that gives you a sense of being good enough or better than others. These sources of functional righteousness disconnect us from the power of the gospel. They allow us to find righteousness in what we do instead of honestly confronting the depth of our sin and brokenness. Furthermore, each of these sources of righteousness is also a way of judging and excluding others. We use them to elevate ourselves and condemn those who aren't as righteous as we are. In other words, finding righteousness in these things leads us into more sin, not less.
Now, to reveal your tendency toward performance, pause and answer this question. As God thinks of you right now, what is the look on his face?
You picture God as disappointed, angry, indifferent. Does his face say, get your act together? Or, if only you could do a little more for me. If you imagine God as anything but overjoyed with you, you have fallen into a performance mindset. Because the gospel truth is, in Christ, God is deeply satisfied with you. In fact, based on Jesus' work, God has adopted you as his own son or daughter. Galatians 4:7. But when we fail to root our identity in what Jesus has done for us, we slip into performance-driven Christianity. We imagine that if we're better Christians, God will approve of us more fully. Living this way saps the joy of delight out of following Jesus, leaving us to wallow in a joyless, dutiful obedience. Our gospel becomes very small.
Performance-driven Christianity is actually a minimizing of God's holiness. Thinking we can impress God with our quote-unquote right living shows that we've reduced his standards far below what they actually are. Rather than being awed by the infinite measure of his holy perfection, we have convinced ourselves that if we just try hard enough, we can merit God's love and approval.
Our subtle tendencies toward pretending and performing show that failing to believe the gospel is the root of all our more observable sins. As we learn to apply the gospel to our unbelief, to preach the gospel to ourselves, we will find ourselves free from the false security of pretending and performing. Instead, we will live in the true joy and freedom promised to us by Jesus. We'll think more about that next time.
Not to puff any of you up, but several of you really have reading righteousness. I mean, just really good reading. Some really good readers out there. So thank you for everybody who read. Let's talk about the top line, if we could, in the cross chart or gospel grid, as they call it. I wonder if you've ever wanted not to know God's view on something, so you didn't have to change your. That's what the Buddhists call ignorance is bliss. It's not really a Buddhist thing; it's an American thing, I guess. Ignorance is bliss. So if I find out, you know, we have a famous, some of you real old timers will know this, but the young adult, Missy and I used to lead the young adults. And one time I took a trip with two of the young adults to get a dog, a red mastiff that we bought up in northwest Georgia. And when they got me in the car, they thought, man, we can ask this guy any question we want now, you know? And they said, how far is too far to go? You know what I'm talking about? With a woman. How far is too far to go as a Christian with a woman? And I said, well, you know, my view is if you're kissing her, then you're kissing someone's wife. In other words, if you're not married to her, she's either going to be your wife or someone else's wife. So, you know, if you're not going to marry her, I wouldn't even advise kissing, you know. I've changed a little bit on that view, by the way. So anyway, they ended up writing a song about it called If You Ain't Gonna Keep Her, Don't Even Kiss Her.
You're not going to tell us who these people are.
No, but they're, one of their initials is Daryl Keatley, who's still in the church. Okay, so again, if we know that, then it just kind of makes it harder on us. And, you know, there is something to that theologically. Because once you give someone the law, inexplicably, we start to dream about breaking it. You know what I mean? Humpty Dumpty, there was this New Yorker cartoon, which, you know, they're the greatest cartoons. So Humpty Dumpty's walking down the street, and there's a sign that says, "Do not sit on wall." And this thought bubbles come up, and he says, "I never thought about sitting on the wall before." You know? So, you know, do not walk on grass. People say, "I wonder how it would feel to walk on grass." You walked on grass a million times, but this grass, I bet it will feel different. So, you know, there is something about getting the law that incites us to sin. What about when you think, because we're talking about God's nature as holy and as merciful, we're talking about God's nature as transcendent and immanent. When you think about the holiness of God, does it move you to fear or does it move you to worship? Both? Anyone? I think in Isaiah 6, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He says, holy, 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 and he fears, and then he worships. So I think both is the right answer, but sometimes we may only go one way or the other. How would you respond to the question that's like the kind of the bottom line question in the first part of the article that looks at the top line? It says, as God thinks of you right now, what is the look on his face? Mm-hmm. Anyone?
Disappointment.
A little bit, maybe a little bit of disappointment? Others? You don't think that way?
He's unhappy.
You think you think of him as being unhappy?
He has a very happy face when he looks at me.
Okay.
I think he loves us.
Okay.
My son, I mean, I may not be happy with something he's done, but what overrides everything is the fact that I love him so much. I would do anything to continue to communicate and to help him understand whatever it is that I feel he's not understanding.
Yes, okay. Anyone else? Debbie?
As soon as I read that, I thought I was going to do a happy face, and I couldn't figure out whether it was going to be happy or sad. So it was like an empty circle.
Yeah.
But then by the
they have that emoji, by the way, that has like a squiggly.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, oh, okay.
But by the end of the paragraph where it says, God sees Jesus in me.
Okay.
I said, forget that happy face.
Okay, okay,
he
good.
Sees a happy face, and he's just giving me that second, third, fourth, chance for me to change.
Yeah.
With love.
Okay. Yes, Al.
Thank goodness I already saved him, because otherwise.
Okay. All right. Yes, sorry, Mike.
No, I think sometimes for me it's the difference between knowing a fact and appreciating a fact. Like, I can know how to, someone can learn how to convert dollars to euros, but not necessarily know the buying power of a euro.
Okay.
So it's like you have to sort of, the fact that you can know something, but it's got to sink in and then affect change. That's where the tensions.
Yes. Okay. I was going by the door today into the sanctuary, and Matt was playing some music, and I don't know, Judy, you were there, and some others were singing in the choir, and he played this first five notes from Beethoven's Fifth. Yeah. And I thought, wow, what is that doing for people? You know, that made me shocking them. But I thought, I know Beethoven's Fifth. But I don't really know Beethoven's Fifth. In fact, I couldn't even play those five notes. I think it's five of the same note, isn't it? Or
no,
the last one's different. Dun dun dun. Dun.
Right.
Okay. See, I didn't even know that. But again, I could recognize it, know it, but not know it. And you know, I think, and this is really what this whole class is about: the long, long prayer that gets interrupted by Ephesians 2 and the beginning of 3. So it starts off with Ephesians 1, and then, it picks up because the same words introduce it in the end of chapter 3. And what is that prayer about? You know, I think, like, here's Paul. He plants this church. He hangs out in Ephesus for a long time. He even started a seminary in Ephesus. The school of Tyrannus was in Ephesus. You know, it was like a... You know, it sounds like it was like an old West town. You know, there was a big temple of Artemis there, and the Christians got in trouble because they said, we don't worship idols anymore, and the idol company like went out of business, and everyone turned against the Christians. And what does he say after knowing them this well? He says, my great prayer for you is this: that the eyes of your heart might be enlightened, so that you may know the power and the hope of his calling. And then he says, that Christ may dwell in your hearts by faith. Excuse me. I've been to Vacation Bible School. Thank you, Paul. And everyone who's even gone to Vacation Bible School knows that Jesus dwells in the heart of the Christian by faith. We ask our little kids where they, of course, they go, what does that mean? Would you like to invite Jesus into your heart? You know, of course, they're thinking, boom, 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 boom. And then how is Jesus going to get in there? But we, all of our kids know, they don't really know what it means, do we? That Jesus dwells in your heart by faith. But Paul prays for Christians. I pray that Christ would dwell in your heart by faith. Well, he's pointing at exactly what the professor is pointing to, which is, he dwells, but he doesn't really dwell, you know? And the secret to the Christian life is knowing our sinfulness and God's mercy, you know? Our being made in the image of God and being fallen, and God holy and merciful. And knowing that at a deeper level, and how the gospel brings the grace of God to us, so that we, you mentioned InterVarsity. I'm not sure if this is an InterVarsity thing or a Navigator thing, but My Heart, Christ's Home. Has anyone ever read that little thing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a little booklet, My Heart, Christ's Home. And it's a little parable about Jesus coming into your heart, and it's like a house. And he says, let's go into the kitchen. And you say, oh no, I eat too much. I don't want to bring Jesus into the kitchen. He'll say, wow, what are these potato chips you have? Yep. Or then he says, can we go in the entertainment room? And we say, oh, I watched some things that I shouldn't watch, and I spend too much time in this or that. And he wants to go into every room of the house, you know, and we, you know, kind of want to shut the door. I think of it as, and I think this is a way, Mike, to go from knowing about the Euro to, like, knowing the Euro. You're in good company, by the way. Jonathan Edwards had a famous sermon about, we know honey, we might know the viscosity of honey, we might know the colors of honey, we might know the sources of honey, whether it's clover leaf honey or orange blossom honey or whatever, but you don't really know honey until it hits your tongue, you know? And so what was I saying? I forgot about that. Too many. In the house. Okay. So I think of Jesus coming when he comes into my house as an exterminator. And you know, I could ask here, and I know with 100% certitude that there would be universal no to this question. How many people here love cockroaches? Zero. But I know one man that loves cockroaches. Because it keeps him in a job. It's the exterminator, right? And I think of Jesus coming into my house saying, hey, can we go in there? And I'm like, no, it's full of roaches. And he says, that's what I'm here for. I'm here to exterminate roaches. I'm here to liberate you from the things that ruin life. The more access you give me, the more I can help you, you know? But you have to come out with your hands up, and you have to be willing to see sin even in some of your subtle and apparently good behaviors, because you're doing the right behavior sometimes for the wrong reasons, all right? So again, knowing, great. All right, how about, let's just kind of jump to the end here, but how does it feel when you are convicted that something you're doing is sinful? And somebody perhaps points it out to you. Anyone? How does that feel to you? Just guilty?
I get
defensive. Okay. You feel defensive and then terrible. Okay.
Yeah.
That's like doubly beautiful. It's defensive and then terrible. Yeah, yeah.
Confident Americans.
Confident Americans, sorry. So again, some of you have come to the Inquirers class and know about my driving, my educational driving.
And the dishwasher.
Yeah, and the dishwasher. That stupid dishwasher. So when Missy points out, TJ, are you trying to teach that guy something? Which, you know, I am, because it's my duty as a citizen, you know? And so, I'm, you know, he pulled out in front of me going like 10 miles an hour, and I'm going 50. And so I pulled right up on him to say, how you doing, pal? Right behind you. And Missy's like, yeah, so you feel like that's your duty to teach him right now? I'm not defending this right now. It's terrible. It's a terrible part of my sinful person.
It's even worse if somebody does the opposite, right? Goes right in front of you and then blocks the whole road.
Yes. Okay. So you're like me, son, Sandra. Another educational driver. I thank you for jumping in with me. So again, when Missy points that out to me, my first inclination is to say, "Who goes 10 miles an hour?" You know, or usually it's more like, who goes 45 mile an hour in a 35 mile zone? Yeah. You know, like that. So quite often, it's like goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. What do they do when they are first convicted of sin? They run, hide, they cover, and then they point the finger eventually at God. It's the woman you gave me, right? So lastly, the question is posed in the article, what do you count on to give you a sense of personal credibility? What do you count on to give you a sense of personal credibility, validity, acceptance, and good standing? I have to say, there are sometimes when... There have been times in the past, especially when I first came here, it's an older lady coming down the hallway as I'm going to the front of the church. I'm going this way down the hallway. She's coming this way. It's her first time here. She sees this young fella in a wheelchair. This obviously isn't happening now, but it happened like 5 years ago. All right, maybe 25 years ago. All right, but so 25 years ago, she sees this young guy in a wheelchair, and then she puts her hands like this, she puts them between her knees, and she pushes her knees together, and she says, "Hi, how are you?" All right, and then I think, ain't she gonna be surprised when I show up? You know, but there are times, you know, where I have to admit, I say, you know, I'm the pastor. I'll go to Einstein's. What are you doing here? You know, I work over at the church. I'm the pastor. And, you know, we all use those kind of things to try to get a little, like, respect from people, a little cred, like we say. Cred. And we all do that. So, you know, ask yourself, is it dishwasher righteousness? Is it travel righteousness? It's very helpful to have this vocabulary to be able to, you know, point out to others, I have political righteousness. It's a major, major problem in our culture. Everybody thinks because of the political views that they're more righteous than others. Again, theological righteousness. Are you going to the Ligonier Conference? You know, which I think you should go. It's great, but we can really camp on that. Flexibility righteousness. Last thing I'll say, and I hope you'll work through that little discussion that we gave you, the right and wrong exercise. But we have to recognize our tendency. One of our tendencies is describing my sin one way and describing your sin another way. So I say, Brittany, kind of lazy. Me? I'm kind of a laid-back person. You know? Brittany, driven. She's a driven person. TJ? I'm, you know, hard worker. You know? And Brittany's neither of those, by the way. She's, you know, sorry to use you as an example. Or maybe you're both. I don't know. Probably are. Like I am. So again, we say he's a lecherous old man. I'm a little flirty. You know, and we can do that with anything. And we should get in the habit, I think, in this way, of not giving ourselves the benefit of the doubt, because when we're hiding our sin and when we're closing the door so the exterminator can't get in, it really doesn't help us. You know, it only helps when we can be honest about our failings, and even with the people around us. And then, you know, we're putting ourselves in a good position for, we're going to talk about the spirit of truth in the service today, and I love how one of my Episcopalian friends put it, the spirit is claiming territory in the dark continent of my soul. The spirit is claiming territory in the dark continent of my soul. I just think that's great. You know, my unconquered soul is the Spirit's project, and He is moving higher up and further in, and He's planting His flag deeper and deeper in the dark continent of my soul until eventually, I know you guys find this hard to believe, but I'm going to be just like Jesus, and it's going to take a long time, you know, and then it's going to happen instantaneously.
Yeah,
be like Jesus. I am. Yeah, I know you don't think that about me.
TJ,
yes.
I think that's interesting that you would close like that, because I read that piece, not very well, but at the end where it said, how did his face appear?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because when I think about that, for me, I feel like it's joyous, the face would have been, because there's a blueprint that he's written for me, us, to try to attain,
mm-hmm.
to try to learn, to try to walk. So as long as, you know, to try and to understand that that's what it's about, maybe,
mm-hmm.
would bring joy,
yeah.
to the face of the Most High.
Sure, good, that's mm-hmm. good. All right. Thanks again so much for being here. And again, this is a kind of class that is not only informational but formational. So it would be even good as you go through the class to ask a friend to pray with you, because these are the kind of things that can. Joanne is one of the big fans of this class because she's taken it before. And when I remember the first time she took it, she said, this is like the best kept secret at this church. Right? You know, what about this class? So again, how to live in the power of the gospel. All right, go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Thank you.